Yes, good morning, Catherine.
Good morning. COVID-19 is having a massive impact on global mobility as people the world over essentially stay put. What are the implications for New Zealand in terms of immigration? Statistics New Zealand data suggests that 2019 saw the largest net migration gain ever. 2020 looks like it will be the opposite. Massey University demographer and distinguished Professor Paul Spoonley is with us. Paul, just how is this going to track internationally, I guess? The first point is border restrictions likely to stay in place for quite some time.
Yes, they are, Catherine. And the answer, to be fair, is that we don't really know. However, I'm part of a couple of groups. One is being the Pew Research Group, who've brought together a group of international experts, and we're just trying to map it. So our best guess is that there's going to be a short-term effect, which probably is going to last longer than most people anticipate. So we're talking at least a year from now in terms of border closures or restricted travel. And just to let you know that 184 countries have implemented 35,000 new restrictions on international travel. So it is huge. And then there's a longer term, which starts to get a bit more difficult. But what we're beginning to see is some countries, Hungary, the US, where there has been quite strong anti-immigrant politics, they're beginning to close down in quite a different way. And the fear is that those are going to be permanent changes, not temporary changes. So we're going to get a little bit of out of kilter. So New Zealand might be open for business in a year or 2 years. It's not clear that many other countries will be.
What are the implications then for our settings as they've been? What will be the flow-on effects?
Well, let's talk about what Immigration New Zealand are doing. And by the way, I need to acknowledge that I think they've done quite a good job in terms of managing in a very short period what's happening. So just to let you and the listeners know, they've moved quite quickly to close down the borders, but they've got some exemptions. So there are still people for humanitarian or other reasons who can continue to apply to come to New Zealand. But under the skilled migration visa, that's all on hold. It's what they call deferred. So it's deferred indefinitely. But we've got a large group of workers who are still in New Zealand, about 85,000, who are on either study or work visas. And what the Immigration New Zealand have done is say, we are prepared to change the conditions of your visa, particularly if you're in essential services. And the two, I've got a slight smile in my voice, the two that they've identified are health, which you can understand, and the other one is supermarkets. If you're working in those essential industries, then we're going to allow you to depart from your visa conditions. So, for example, if you're a student, you could only work 20 hours a week. Well, that no longer applies, and you can do that over the next 3 months. And then in some other categories, they've given you a 12-month extension. So I think that's practical, and it recognises that people are here. I've heard the news story earlier. I'm not sure what the issues are around those in Queenstown, whether or not they were in work when the lockdown came on. But certainly in terms of adjusting our policy settings, Immigration New Zealand, I think, have done quite a good job to reflect employer interest, but also the conditions of those who are here on temporary visas.
I think the Queenstown case, they had lost jobs, many of them, just before the lockdown, so they're kind of in limbo. And some had booked flights home that got cancelled, but there's a significant number of them, goodness, thousands.
Yes, well, I mean, we had about 170,000 temporary visitors that's either on a study or a work visa here at the beginning of the lockdown. So we've been identified in the international literature as one of those countries that's being looked at very closely to see what we do in terms of those who people who are onshore but are on temporary visas in some way. And can I just contrast that? The US has gone hard. The US has gone very punitive on those people who are onshore and whose visa or residency status is not clear. So unless you've had a green card for 5 years, you're not eligible for the new provisions to deal with COVID-19.
Let's look at some of the short-term implications. What we have seen, particularly with the kiwifruit picking and some of the harvest is a lot more New Zealanders taking up those jobs, understandably, given people are losing jobs. A lot more New Zealanders taking up those jobs. I think it was Kiwifruit that said normally it's 90%, goodness, I want to get this figure right, migrant labour, it's now more 50-50. It may have been 50-50 and it's gone to 90 in New Zealand, but whatever. There was a big, big pickup in the number of New Zealanders filling jobs typically done by migrants. Is that likely to fill many gaps and shortages in the primary sector and elsewhere adequately in the short term?
No, I don't think it is. And when I was talking to your producer, Claire, I rather likened it to being a drug addict. And the drug in this case is immigrant labour. So right across the many industries and sectors in New Zealand, we've become very, very reliant on migrant labour. And so kiwifruit would be a classic case in point. And it's really that ability to then think, well, I mean, I think all countries are going to privilege their own citizens during this period because we've got people who are moving out of employment and we need to try and get them into other jobs. So no country is going to say, well, we're going to keep bringing in the number of migrants we have if we've got New Zealanders in this case who are out of work. But when you look across those sectors, if you look at elder care, for example, a third of all elder care workers are on some sort of visa. And how fast are we going to be able to plug that gap if we're not letting new people come in? And there are, remember, a number of these people are on temporary visas anyway. So even though we've extended them between their visas for between 3 and 12 months, there's going to come a point where the government and the employers are going to say, well, we're not going to experience a supply of workers for our industry that have typically in the past come from migrants from offshore. So where are those new people going to come from? And it's going to be a real test in terms of labour market flexibility. How good are we going to be at moving people who've become unemployed in New Zealand in this period to new areas, new sectors, probably new parts of the country? I did the Alps to Ocean bike ride just before the lockdown, I might add. And when you go into a place like Mount Cook Village, there are literally no New Zealanders employed there. So are we going to be able to convince New Zealanders to go and live in Mount Cook Village and work in the industry there, even accepting that probably the number of people going to visit Mount Cook is going to drop?
Okay. The figure was, sorry, we just need to ride that team, just ride Paul's feedback. Thank you. The figure was that 90% of New Zealanders at the moment in kiwifruit picking as opposed to 50% last season. So that was the way that had played out. I suppose that's the difficulty, Paul, particularly with tourism taking the hit that it is and hospitality taking the hit that it is. It's difficult to know what the demand for workers is going to be over the next year, isn't it? And also, if we've got unemployment, and we have, heading to 10%, what is it that would facilitate New Zealanders being able to take up those jobs? What are the barriers typically that stop people moving, as you say, to a different place, away from home, perhaps away from family, away from accommodation, and with enough pay to make the move worth it? Does that remain a challenge in a high unemployment situation, one that we haven't had for a while?
It does. And I think we need to put the pay levels alongside the conditions of work. So if you think of our dairy industry, that has moved very extensively to rely on immigrant workers, largely Filipino. And one of the concerns is that, well, one of the reasons for that is that Filipinos are prepared to do that work in various parts of New Zealand where either there aren't New Zealanders to fill those jobs or the New Zealanders are not keen on those jobs. So perhaps if you've been made redundant, then you're going to look at it slightly differently. But I think there's a broader institutional issue, Catherine, and that is that this is one of those moments. Perhaps the last one that, well, the last two would have been the GFC and then the labour market reforms that we implemented in the 80s and early 90s, where we don't have institutions that allow people to retrain or upskill or incentives for them to move to other parts of the country to take up some of these vacancies. So we've got about 14,000 recognised seasonal employment labourers in New Zealand to pick and process our horticultural and agricultural crops. So that's not a small amount. And if we do we want to go cold turkey on that and say, well, no, we're not going to have those workers from the Pacific come in and do that. We're going to have our own people. Who are those people? Where are they? And what are the incentives for them to look at those jobs in a much more positive way? So I think one of the things is, what are going to be the incentives that the government can put in place? What are employers going to do? Because they play a key role in this. And then what are our training and educational institutions going to do to help improve the flexibility of our workforce? Can I just finish that by saying, I use the image of a drug before, probably inappropriately, but you know, there are a lot of industries in New Zealand and a lot of employers in New Zealand who now absolutely rely on migrant labour. And if that tap's going to be turned off, they're going to experience cold turkey.
What are the longer term implications? Because the other thing that occurs to me is that the underpinning of our headline GDP figures, growth figures, by what has essentially been population growth, much of it through immigration. I don't know if you want to comment on that, but more broadly, our economy's dependence on a significant incoming migrant flow has been quite the story for quite some time. Can we change that story? Is there a reason to beyond perhaps the immediate crisis?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, I think we're like Australia and Canada. All three of us rely on migrants to do two things. One is to provide skills. So we've rehearsed that particular question. The other one is it's a major driver of population growth. So two-thirds of our population growth in New Zealand over the last two decades has come from migration. And one of the things that it does is it begins to balance out the demographic profile nationally, but also within communities. So you see migrants coming in, typically as a prime working age migrant, then having families and helping contribute to the pool of people, both in terms of the labour market, but also in terms of the demography of New Zealand. That's one of the areas that we're talking about with Pew in terms of the demographic impacts. And we've got a group of economists who are also talking about what it means for GDP, what it means for demand. So I'm relying on them at this point. But some of that demand is going to decline. So for the demand for housing in Auckland should go down because there are fewer migrants coming into the city on an annual basis. But of course, then we've got to deal with the historical deficit of housing and suitable housing in Auckland. But there should be positives in terms of declining demand for some services. But what are you going to do in terms of this period? How long it's going to be, we don't know. But we're saying between 2 and 5 years in which you're simply not seeing migrants arriving in the country. There's an obvious side, if I can just add quickly, Catherine, and that is that we've got 1 million New Zealanders who live in other countries. Your family and my family all have people, all members of our family who live in other countries. So mobility is not just simply about people coming into the country. It's also about, you know, going to visit those relatives, going to be part of an international family. And of course, the largest group of those are in Australia. But you know, the limited mobility has implications right across the board.
The question is how many of those New Zealanders might come home. And we're in the eye of the storm at the moment. But nonetheless, it does often cause people to think about their medium-term planning. Do we have a sense yet of when we might see quite an influx of those New Zealanders coming back here? They're at a stage of their lives where they were perhaps nearly ready to and are bringing it forward.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the figures for the last year, which is up to February 2020, for migration are very interesting, but they're premature because we really want to see what those figures look like in March and April. And I think we're just going to see the permanent arrivals drop off the edge of a cliff. It's just going to disappear. But we're beginning to see for the first time since 1983 a excess of New Zealanders arriving versus those departing. So it's still small. It's a net gain of about 800. But in my experience, whenever you get these international shocks like the GFC and things like the Bali bombing or the Chernobyl incident in Russia, you get New Zealanders thinking, well, do I really want to stay in a country which is not looking after me, like Australia? Do I want to be in a country where there are these threats to my job or to who I am? So we're beginning to see that arrival back of New Zealanders. And I expect that to compensate, not to a great degree, but to compensate for the loss of permanent arrivals or immigrants coming to New Zealand.
Paul, New Zealanders are coming. Sorry, you've already explained it more fully, but could I get you just to end with the two priority things you believe our planners need to be looking at short to medium term? That's twofold. One is how to get the newly unemployed into vacancies that won't be filled by migrant labour. And then number two is to think what our immigration policy is going to look like beyond this year. Would they be two of the really big priorities that people need to turn their minds to as soon as possible?
Yes, they are. And in terms of the first, we've not done a particularly good job of matching labour market demand with supply. And that's why we've tended to rely on migration, because it makes our job a lot easier. So what are going to be the incentives for those New Zealanders who are now unemployed to look at a new job or a new location? And then what are we going to provide by way of training and upskilling so that they are prepared for those jobs? A number of those jobs probably don't need a lot of skill training, but there's still going to be some. I mean, you can come out of a very skilled job and still not have the basic skills to do what others would regard as a low-skilled job, let's say in a supermarket. So that's one issue. The second issue, I think, around migration is we need a population policy, and we need to think about what the contribution migration will play in the future. The difficulty is we've got control of this country and of its borders, but other countries are going to be doing very different things. I don't think China, for example, is going to allow its best and brightest to keep migrating to New Zealand or any other country, because they are experiencing their own demographic crisis, quite apart from anything economic there. We really do need to reset what we're going to do about migration and the mix that we see in New Zealand between migrant labour and New Zealand labour, because otherwise that becomes a real political liability. It becomes something in which you pit an unemployed New Zealander against an employed migrant, and we don't want to go there.
Thank you so much, Paul Spoonley.